morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Tuesday, January 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Chad's military leader names opposition leader as the country's new prime minister.
The appointment of Mr. Mastra is, a new approach for the second hand of the transition, because the transition prompts the reconciliation.
Guinea's military junta says it will hold a constitutional referendum sometime this year. Uganda's opposition FDC calls on members to express interest in running for office in the next general election. South Africa mourns the death of renowned artist-photographer Peter Magubane. Somaliland agrees to allow Ethiopia to use its Berbera port.
It's a milestone. It's very historical. Because with this signing of agreement with Somaliland, Ethiopia will have access, unlimited use of the port of Berbera.
And Malawi bans maize imports from Kenya and Tanzania over disease concerns. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Chad's military leader, General Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno, on Monday named opposition leader Success Mastra as the country's new prime minister. The French news agency AFP reports the announcement was made through a decree. Mastra returned to Chad this past November from exile. His spokesperson declined to comment on the grounds that he has not yet formally accepted the offer. His appointment follows the resignation of his predecessor on December 30. Clement Abaifuta is president of the Chadian Association of Victims of Political Repression and Crimes, which investigates abuses committed by former Chadian president Hissin Habre. He tells me that Mastra's appointment fulfills the aspirations of Chadian youth and that it means that the transition to democratic rule is on track.
The appointment of Mr. Mastra is, a new approach for the second hand of the transition. Because the transition prompted the reconciliation. And as Mastra accepted to come back home, I think that it is an opportunity for most of youth. You know, the youth think that the new era has come for the Chadian to dream a new dream.
So do you think Mr. Mastra will accept the position?
Yes, according to what they signed 2 weeks or 1 month ago, I think that it's linked that he would accept it to become the new prime minister after the first hand of the transition. I think that the president has the challenge to build a new conception of his politics. According to what is going now, I think that is a good approach.
But Clement, under the new constitution, Mohamed Deby is eligible to run for president this year. If Mastra accepts to be prime minister, what would that mean for Mastra himself or his ambition to run for president someday?
What I'm seeing is, through what his many speech, he's used to say that he is looking. The coming election, he has the personal ambition to go in the election of presidents. So I think that there's no doubt that he will deal with election.
So there is a possibility that if the military leader, Mohamed Deby, wants to run for president also, they can clash.
I don't wish that, According to the new constitution, every Chadian who has 37 years, he have the overland to deal with the election. So I think that what I know is there is no clash, but I don't wish it. I wish the best for our country, for the President Mohamed Kaka and the new Prime Minister, Dr. Mastra.
Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of former Chadian President Hissin Habre's crimes. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. Guinea's military junta says it will hold a constitutional referendum sometime this year. The French news agency AFP reports junta leader Kona Mamadi Doumbouya made the announcement on Sunday in his end-of-the-year speech. The referendum is a major step in Guinea's return to civilian rule after Doumbouya seized power in 2021. Faya Milimono is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party in Guinea. He tells me Guineans are eager to see the draft of the new constitution and the date for the referendum.
In the president's speech, he talked about the referendum to be held this year. The first understanding that we have of that statement is that, if you remember the last transitional period Guinea had in 2008 and 2010, we had rewrote the constitution, but the constitution was not submitted to the referendum. This time, as he comes to it again, it is sure that the referendum is going to be held to adopt the new constitution. But we first need to see the draft of that constitution, because when the draft is going to be presented to the people, there will be a good debate as to, you know, what contract we are trying to establish with the people of Guinea.
Now, the military leader has also been talking about other issues in terms of how the country should run the offices of local government officials. What did he have to say?
Yeah, I mean, since the beginning of the transitional period, there are some actors, political or civil society actors, who had requested, as the legislative body was removed, the elected legislative body was removed, the president was removed, people were calling for the removal of the local government. So this year, he said clearly that during the first of 2024, he's going to remove all those local governments to replace them by appointees. So the Minister of Territorial Administration is going to appoint people in the place of the elect local officials.
There was a constitutional referendum during the Alpha Conde regime, when we say that led to the military takeover. What would you think the military government would like to change in a new referendum?
The first thing that we have to mention is that, yes, we did the referendum during Alpha Conde time. But here was the problem, though. When the draft was presented to the people, the referendum was organized and people voted to accept or to refuse the draft. And what, after the vote, after the referendum, the copy of the constitution was not the draft that was submitted to the people. There was a footnote somewhere.
Before I let you go, what is the latest now since the fuel depot explosion? Is life getting back to normal now?
I would say not yet, because it is still very difficult to have cars in. You see people, the very long, long line at the gas stations. The situation is far from becoming normal, and people are even expecting the crisis to be worse.
Thank you so much. A pleasure again to speak with you, and Happy New Year.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you too.
Faya Milimono is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Ethiopia and Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland announced on Monday that they have reached an agreement for Ethiopia to use Somaliland's Barbara port. According to the French news agency, the EFP, the agreement would enable Ethiopia, a landlocked country, to gain access to the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. Brooke Hailu is a former adjunct professor of political science at North Carolina A&T State University and is now general manager of Nahu TV, one of the largest private TV stations in Ethiopia. He tells me the agreement fulfills Ethiopia's long desire for access to the sea.
It's a milestone. It's very historical because Ethiopia needs access to the sea. So with this signing of agreement with Somaliland, Ethiopia will have access, unlimited use of the port of Berbera, which is very, very large and which is very near to the Ethiopian border. So Ethiopia was really looking for to use one of the ports in the Horn of Africa. With Eritrea, there were so many promises, but nothing materialized. So now Ethiopia is moving towards Somaliland. So the agreement is to use their port, as well as to eventually establish a military port in the Berbera area.
This is Somaliland, but help us understand, this be any friction between Ethiopia and Somalia?
Yes, a good question. I would say time will tell. When I say time will tell, I mean by tomorrow or in the coming 4, 5, 6 hours, I expect a press conference from the Somali Transitional Federal Government in Mogadishu. So we're going to be listening to their reaction as to this agreement between Ethiopia and the breakaway state of Somaliland. We are still waiting for the Somali government in Mogadishu for its reaction. But one thing is for sure, Ethiopia has decided to go ahead and establish a very solid relations with the breakaway state of Somaliland. That is now, it's no longer a secret, it's very open now.
That is very interesting, because would this bring about any confusion between Ethiopia and Somalia?
Not so confusion, but this is irritation, you know, diplomatic irritation. I would call it as diplomatic hiccups and the like, because literally Ethiopia is going around the Horn of African countries, literally asking them to use their ports. Even they have approached Somalia. They have approached Eritrea and Somaliland. Ethiopia even declared last month or 2 months ago, Ethiopia has a very historical right to have access to the sea. It shouldn't be destined to be landlocked. You know, there is the United Nations Law of the Sea Conference, as well as there are a number of United Nations conventions where it was agreed landlocked countries should be given access to the sea for their imported exports. So Ethiopia had pleaded with the neighboring countries, you know, to sign with Ethiopia, you know, a solid agreement. And Ethiopia even declared it is willing to pay a hefty sum for the lease with Eritrea, with Somalia and the others. Even the prime minister declared that it is ready even to give them 20%, 25% of the very successful Ethiopian airlines. Can you believe that, James?
Really?
Yes, because nothing is for free. And Ethiopia said peacefully, please, let's use your port. And Ethiopia is the most developed and economically heavyweight country. But they did not respond positively, especially Somalia. So now it seems Ethiopia has decided to go ahead and deal directly with the breakaway nation.
What about Eritrea? Wouldn't that be a problem also?
No, not a problem. By the way, Ethiopia is literally pleading with Eritrea to be able to use Asab and Massawa, which used to be Ethiopian ports, by the way, for years, you know that. So Eritrea, it seems, has not responded to the request of Ethiopia. That's why the Ethiopian government has started to deal with other Horn countries, because there is lack of response on the part of Eritrea.
Brooke Hailu is a former adjunct professor of political science at North Carolina A&T State University. He is now the general manager of Nahu TV, one of the largest private TV stations in Ethiopia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Addis Ababa. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bott in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 2nd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Uganda, the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC, is calling on members of the party to express interest in elective positions to represent the group in the next general election. The FDC says the move is meant to give the party enough time to choose its representatives to ensure adequate preparation ahead of the 2026 general election. Ugandans are scheduled to go to the polls to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives in 2026. For more about the opposition party's plan, VOA's Peter Clotty reached Boniface Totiribuka, chairman of the Electoral Commission of the FDC.
The 17th National Council resolved for members to express their interest if they are to contest in the forthcoming election. So the Party Electoral Commission was empowered to go ahead and open up the expression of interest for all elective national positions, those who are interested to contest on the FDC ticket, to express their concern so that we start identifying candidates early enough. We don't need to wait and start panicking, but we have to begin early.
Some people are wondering why the party decided to start so early, since elections are in 2 years' time. Why is the party in a rush, they say, to decide on who will represent the party during the 2026 general election?
The National Council, in its best wisdom, took fit for looking for candidates at this stage, which is actually normal. We look for candidates who are committed to the party, other than waiting for the last minute whistle to look for candidates. So it has been the best wisdom of the National Council to empower the Party Electoral Commission to draw a roadmap. It is always good to have candidates early enough.
Some people are suggesting that the NUP appears to be taking away the shine of the FDC, outperforming the FDC in the last election. So this is a way of the FDC trying to take its mantle back as the biggest opposition party in Uganda. As the Electoral Commission head of the party, what is your reaction to this?
The FDC's objective is to expect the governance of the Republic of Uganda. It's not just being a leading majority party in parliament, leading opposition party, but it is take the reins, the instruments of power of the Republic of Uganda. That is its prime objective, to get power. Win the state presidency, win the parliamentary elections, win the local government elections.
Boniface Totari-Buka is the chairman of the Electoral Commission of Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. South Africa is mourning the death of renowned artist photographer Peter Magubane, who died Monday at age 91. His work documented the struggles of black South Africans during the apartheid era. Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and the former deputy vice chair Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that black South Africans can write their own history because of the work of Peter Magubane.
There was always a need for the history of our struggle and also our political transition. You had journalists, but you also had the photojournalists. You had journalists who aligned themselves with the struggle. Peter Magubane was one of those. He was there during the hard times, conditions of struggle in Soweto. If ever there was brutality, he made sure that that's captured in pictures. And as a result, we are able to write our history using those pictures. He had been there from the 70s and continued until the new democratic dispensation, capturing the entire transition, the massacres in 76, the massacres in Buibatong around 1992-1993. So he has made a valuable contribution in the same way that those of us who write capture history in text, but Peter captured it in pictures. And most importantly, you could say his work represents an eyewitness account of South Africa's political history.
In the world, how is he being remembered there?
Well, my sense is that he has already been remembered because we do have orders or major awards that are given by the state. And he's also a recipient of one of those orders. But I also think that his funeral will also be what you call a state funeral. A state funeral is where the state and the president decide that this person is so important that we would make it a state funeral where he is going to be treated like a minister or somebody who has served as a minister. Peter Magubane played that major role as a truth teller and as a person who chronicled our history. And I think the outpouring of messages from almost every newspaper is more of a reflection of the role that he has played. I do expect that even the journalistic fraternity will be writing a lot of stories and capturing how he has actually contributed to photojournalism as a craft, but also photojournalism as a history or storyteller.
During his work, what part of South Africa was he based?
Well, he was based largely in Johannesburg. He worked for newspapers like The World, The Star, and Sowetan. And he ended up also working as a consultant, where he began to document. And there are a number of books that he has put together, where he has put the pictures that he'd taken as a form of storytelling, providing a chronological order of events. That's why I say his work presents more of an eyewitness account of our history.
Professor, thank you so much. A pleasure to speak with you always, and a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, sir.
Professor Sipho Sipho is a political analyst and the former Deputy Vice Chancellor for Institutional Support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. Tanzania has banned imports from soybeans from Malawi to protect its agricultural sector from the presence of tobacco ring spot virus in Malawi. The Tanzania Plant Health and Pesticide Authority says in a statement that the virus poses significant risks to soybean production in Tanzania. The country has also banned the introduction of genetically modified maize seeds from Malawi to maintain a non-GMO status in its agricultural practices. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Tanzania Plant Health and Pesticide Authority said in a recent statement that its pest risk analysis of soybeans from Malawi has established the presence of the tobacco ring spot virus. The statement says the virus is a highly contagious plant disease that affects soybean crops and can cause significant damage to the plants, leading to yield reduction and economic losses ranging from 25% to 100% to farmers. It has advised all soybean importers in Tanzania to explore alternative countries for soybeans. Tanzania is among big importers of soybeans from Malawi. In February of this year, Tanzania's High Commissioner to Malawi committed to facilitate the purchase of 100,000 metric tons of soybeans from Malawi, worth about $30 million. Agricultural authorities in Malawi says the country harvested about 400,000 metric tons of soybeans in the 2022 to 2023 season. Grace Mijiga Muhango is president of the Grain Traders Association of Malawi. She told VOA that the indefinite ban has put the grain traders in Malawi in an awkward situation.
Because now, for my members, those that were trying to export soya, they can't export, but now they're holding their money and some of the products are in transit. So what that means, they will lose the transport, they will lose the business, where necessary, they might be sued for breach of contract.
The Tanzanian ban comes a few days after Malawi banned maize imports from Tanzania and Kenya over maize lethal necrosis disease in these two countries. Malawi's Minister of Agriculture said in a statement that the disease has no treatment and can cause up to 100% yield loss. However, Mijiga Muhango said the Tanzanian ban on soybean imports from Malawi is not surprising.
We call it a trade war. They started the war and their friends are there fighting back.
Ronald Chirumpa, Malawi Minister of Agriculture, Sam Kawale, told VOA via a messaging up text that he could not comment on a Tanzanian ban on soybean imports from Malawi. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this Tuesday, January 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.